WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
It's Pride Month, and we're talking about Chicago's historic queer neighborhoods. Just prepping for today's show, I learned a ton, and I'm excited for you to learn it too. I'm Patrick Smith, in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Chicago's queer neighborhoods have long been central to the city's LGBTQ+ identity. Spaces where people found community, nurtured social movements, and thrived together in building family. But in a time before North Halsted, formerly known as Boys Town, before the inception of the movement for LGBTQ rights, where did members of Chicago's gay community live? Well, there was Bronzeville, Old Town, even an old bohemian neighborhood called Tower Town. And these neighborhoods tell a buried queer history of urban change and resistance. We wanted to learn more about that history, like what the neighborhoods meant to those who lived there, and how shifts in politics, policing, and gentrification have reshaped their legacy. So we turn to Professor Jenny Breyer, a historian at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Before any neighborhood was named or identified as an LGBTQ-friendly neighborhood per se, Professor Breyer filled us in on what it was like to be queer in Chicago and how folks in this time found community.
Well, I think the first thing it's important to know is that when Chicago is founded in 1837, which you know from the seal that you see on every truck that drives by. There were people who had same-sex desire, and there were people who didn't conform to gender norms. Mm. So while we may today call those people LGBT or queer, they wouldn't have defined themselves as such. But they found a space in Chicago that was a kind of freedom for them. And pretty quickly over the course of the end of the 19th century, you come to understand if you read police records or you read other kinds of sort of more what we might today call more kind of scandalous newsmaking, mm-hmm. like the rags of the time, you'll read about a really rich history of queer sexuality, of non-normative sexuality. There were brothels, there were saloons, there were people getting hassled by the police. And so we understand that history if we're able to go through those legal records. There's also something that I've talked about on this show before. There are also people who we would today call transgender, mm-hmm. who are part of early Chicago formation. People assigned female at birth dressing as men, people assigned male at birth dressing as female, for all sorts of reasons. It's quite a wide open, scandalous town. I mean, it's a rugged place.
Yeah, I was reading, you know, in prepping for this from LGBTQ America from the National Park Service, and they talked about, I think it was in the 1850s, Chicago started passing these sort of decency laws, and one of them aimed at the communities you're talking about was bans on people dressing, you know, sort of against their assigned at birth gender. And then I think, just as a reminder to all any journalists, myself included, of the role we can play, the Tribune did a series sort of exposing, you know, people who were dressing against their gender, their assigned gender. So
there were hundreds and hundreds of these articles throughout the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It was really like, I think it sold newspapers.
Really? Was it ginning up a sort of moral outrage?
I think it was ginning up a moral outrage And it was also telling us something about what was going on. Mm. There's a reason why one of the first ordinances, or at least in the first 20 years of the founding of Chicago, there's a ban against dressing in clothing not belonging to your sex. It appears next to regulations about where you could bathe and where you could tie up your horse. So it is part of what a frontier, quote unquote, sort of city has for itself. So I think it's both about that sold newspapers and it was very prurient and very exciting for people to read, but it also tells us about how people's lived experience really looked.
So as a historian, you're reading that and you're like, it's horrible that this was happening, but also it helps me understand what was going on at the time.
Exactly.
It was interesting reading that from that, you know, talked about queer people coming to Chicago because it offered both anonymity and a place to find community, which I think is a reason a lot of people come to cities in the first place. Were people, despite the you know, journalism and the rules targeting them, were people able to find community?
Absolutely. Here we sort of turn to other kinds of documents that aren't necessarily journalistic documents, but documents that might have been created by the police or by the municipal establishment. There were incredible endeavors to try and target and map and quantify vice in the city. And that was true in New York at the turn of the 20th century as well. So there are these amazing documents about the vice, or this, there's one example called The Social Evil in Chicago from 1911, and I can read you a little bit from it if you'd like. So this is from that 1911 report, I guess is what we would call it today. It appears that in this community, referring to probably the near west side of Chicago, maybe the Levee District, which is what's now the South Loop, there is a large number of men who are thoroughly gregarious in habit, who mostly affect the carriage, mannerism, and speech of women, who are fond of many articles ordinarily dear to the feminine heart, who are often people of a good deal of talent, who leaned to the fantastic in dress and other modes of expression, and who have a definite cult with regard to sexual life.
Mm. Wow. So that you said that's 1911 when that was written. So that's about the time when Tower Town was a predominant, or was it the neighborhood for queer people in Chicago at the time?
Well, the Levee District is one, okay. So that's a little bit south of Tower Town, and there are. It's an incredible red light district, the Levee District. So you can see maps from the 1890s that show all the brothels and the saloons. But then by the sort of 20s, maybe teens, you really start to see this neighborhood called Tower Town emerge near the water tower, the near west side. So we would today call that the Gold Coast.
Yeah.
But to understand what's happening in Chicago in the early 20th century, the Gold Coast is not gold in the early 20th century. It has rooming houses. It has single unit housing. It has speakeasies. It has clubs. I saw a reference, one minister, you know, calling the neighborhood homohemia in 1956 in an account about the neighborhood.
It sounds like a pretty cool, it sounds like a cool place.
Right, not a bad place.
No.
It was also the neighborhood that budding social scientists from the University of Chicago, Ernest Burgess, studied. There were these huge dance halls, taxi dance halls. And then it was also the place where the sex researcher Alfred Kinsey goes to find people to interview for his work.
So it's all happening in homohemia, basically.
It's happening in homohemia. The Dill Pickle Club is there. It's founded in 1914, and you walk down the stairs, and you're under a sign that says, step high, stoop low, leave your dignity outside.
Wow. I mean, this all, like, what a great slogan.
Yeah, it's a good slogan.
Yeah, that's a very good slogan.
Yeah.
So Tower Town, I mean, it honestly sounds, it's a name that you would, like, I feel like in a Dick Tracy comic or something like that. And then Bronzeville, which I know, I think most listeners probably know of as a historically black neighborhood, a place where people settled during the Great Migration. But it was a gay neighborhood in Chicago as well.
I think it's really important to understand that when you talk about the queer history of any city, but particularly Chicago. Chicago is the crossroads of America, as that essay mm-hmm. is titled. It is a site of profound in-migration of people, some from Europe over the course of different waves of what we call immigration. And then, of course, it is the site, one of the main sites of the Black migration, leaving the Jim Crow South and coming to the North in hopes of finding something else. And we know that that doesn't always pan out. But one thing that is very clear is there is a vibrant Black gay world. And it is, and even the Levee District is interracial. It's not segregated in the same way. Over the course of the 20th century, it becomes much more segregated. But even in Bronzeville, there are incredible clubs, there are performance spaces, and we have dozens and dozens and dozens of examples of different performers, some of whom were they're identified as female impersonators. And they are identified as being sepia, so they're not white, they're sepia in color. So that describes the way African-American female impersonators or African-American transgender performers were called sepia, sepia Gloria Swanson, sepia Mae West. They performed at bars across the neighborhood. The Cabin Inn was at 3100, give or take, Cottage Grove. There was a club called the Annex Buffet that was on in the 2800 block of South State Street. You know, there were women jazz performers performing. I mean, it was an incredible mix of things.
Yeah, so queer culture is thriving alongside the jazz and blues scene.
Absolutely.
You mentioned these are not necessarily segregated areas, but how
The Bronzeville is segregated.
Yeah. So how does racial segregation connect to queer expression at the time?
Yeah. So I think it's really important to understand, especially when you think about North Halsted, which of course we all call Boys Town, but they don't call it that anymore. That neighborhood has gone through some incredible transformations, but it has, in some of its origins, has felt like a white space. And the earlier versions of queer life really didn't look the same way. So I guess it's just important to understand that there are for example, the founding of the Society for Human Rights, which is the first gay rights organization that's founded, I think most people would think, by this guy Henry Gerber, who you might know about if you know the Gerber Hart Library. That that organization is founded in 1924. The president of that organization is a Black man who's come up through the Black migration to Chicago.
Wow.
So I think that there's a way that early gay history in Chicago has been whitewashed. We have erased part of the legacy of Black queer people and the way they've built a world that has formed what Chicago looks like.
Tell me a little bit more about this, the Henry Gerber Society for Human Rights. I mean, what did that group do for the development of queer communities and neighborhoods?
Yeah. So it's almost Henry Gerber's birthday. I looked up on the way when I was preparing for today. His birthday is the 29th of this month. So it's in a couple days. He was born in Bavaria and emigrated to the United States, to Chicago, in 1913. And he served in World War I. And he was stationed in Germany, where he started to sort of get exposed to a really vibrant gay life that was in Berlin in the 1920s and 1930s, before the rise of Nazism and obviously Hitler. And he comes back to the States and he starts, he decides to create, he says, with some other homos, basically, is the language he uses, the Society for Human Rights. And that charter is signed in Illinois in 1924. At the same time, he publishes what is probably a community-based, what we would today call a community-based magazine called Friendship and Freedom. There's another magazine that exists in Chicago at the same time, written by, published by lesbian writers called The Little Review, Margaret Anderson and Jane Heap. So there's clearly something going on in the sort of literary texture of the city. And then he decides to create with John Graves, who is this reverend who comes up from the South, and someone named Al Meininger, who we don't know much about. He's defined in one of the documents that Henry Gerber leaves for us as a laundry queen, a bisexual laundry queen. They're both clearly working class people. They are not men of means. They are, right? Henry Gerber works at the post office. And they figure out that they want to create this organization that is quickly shut down by the police. His house is raided. They're all taken to jail. Al and Henry Gerber are taken to a white jail.
Wow.
Graves is taken to a black jail. And they are, that organization is shut down. They're fined. They're fined for disorderly conduct. I read part of what he said in this letter. He wrote a letter recounting it. He said, they had no evidence of homosexual acts except one man. I think that's Al Meininger. They could do nothing but fine us for disorderly conduct, maximum $200 fine, which is a lot in 25.
Yeah.
But I got a lawyer and we got out. It cost me all my savings and I lost my job at the post office over it. None of the homos helped me. The Hearst papers in Chicago had a big headline, strange sex cult exposed, and lied about us, saying that our purpose was to keep men from women.
Wow. I love that you've brought these texts so we can really hear from what was going on at the time. We only have about 30 seconds left, so this is a tough question, but how would you say the current moment in the fight for LGBTQ rights is connected to Chicago's history specifically?
Well, I do want to note that the National Park Service document that you read has been taken down from the National Park Service website. So you cannot find it there. It has been housed at a community-based historical site called outhistory1word.org, where you can read it and it's archived fully. We are under a moment where history is fundamentally being erased and it's fundamentally being taken down, and our access to it. We have to rely on things like this to make sure that people can hear what has happened, because the federal government is trying to, in essence, erase that history. And Chicago is a place where that has happened. Over the long course of its history. And I think we really can be at the forefront of making sure that people still know this history into the 21st century.
Well, thank you for being a part of that. I wish we could talk for even longer, but we have to leave it there. Professor Jenny Breyer, a historian at the University of Illinois Chicago, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced and mixed by Ari Mejia. It was edited by Meha Ahmad. On Reset, we take you back in time as well as stay present to bring you the stories that keep you connected to Chicago and beyond. Make sure to hit subscribe wherever you listen or visit us at wbez.org/reset. I'm Patrick Smith, in for Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for tuning in.
Love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.